This episode is presented by Henry's Wine and Spirit.
Hello. Welcome to Cutting the Curd on Heritage Radio Network. Today, I want to welcome the esteemed Dr. Catherine Donnelly, Professor of Nutrition and Food Sciences at the University of Vermont, who has written a very amazing and upsetting book called Ending the War on Artisan Cheese. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Diane.
I'm very excited about this interview.
And I am too.
Okay. Now, the subtitle of your book is The Inside Story of Government Overreach and the Struggle to Save Traditional Raw Milk Cheesemakers. So, first, Dr. Donnelly, can you tell us where you work and what you do, which pretty much puts you at the center of the scientific cheese world?
Yes. So I have been a professor of nutrition and food science at the University of Vermont for 36 years. And some of my duties there involve teaching a graduate level food safety and public policy class, as well as my research that has been focused on working with Vermont's artisan cheese community and artisan cheesemakers nationally, really, to help put in place safety protocols to produce safe cheese products. And so I initially wrote this book thinking that most individuals don't, and many of our students that were educating in food systems at the University of Vermont, don't understand the degree to which regulations shape their food choices. And so I thought I would use artisan cheese as an example of some of the regulatory constraints that confront artisan cheesemakers. But I think what I found in researching the book surprised even me in terms of the degree to which these regulations were really punishing the artisan cheese community.
Well, it certainly surprised me. I sort of believed when people said that the FDA comes to our conferences and that implied we were working together or trying to. And the book is so intense. It builds and builds the case with lots of science and many initials. Some are a little confusing, but it's quite a predicament. But is it currently still going on?
So what's interesting is when the FDA has been challenged on certain regulations, and I write a chapter about very stringent E. coli standards, you know, when we present the scientific evidence that these standards are inconsistent with what is done in Europe and are really creating a trade barrier because it's going to prevent raw milk cheeses from not only entering this country, but domestic U.S. artisan cheesemakers were having trouble complying with these standards. And the standards had no correlation to food safety that the FDA's own data showed, as well as data that we produced. And so when challenged by congressional representatives, including some from Vermont, the FDA backed down on E. coli issues. The same with wooden boards. When the FDA announced that they were now going to start enforcing a ban on the use of wooden boards in cheese aging, again, the science was not supportive of FDA's position. And again, when challenged by a large number of members of Congress, I think ultimately 56 signed a letter asking the FDA to back off from this issue. And they did end up backing off. And so, you know, if these regulations were so strongly based in science as to form policy, and then the FDA's backing away, it really makes you wonder why they didn't do a more thorough investigation of their own policies in the first place before right. announcing these policies to the artisan cheese community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you have a very nice quote early in the book saying, the artisan production contributes to a biodiverse microflora in cheese, which in turn imparts unique sensory attributes. Can you explain that a little?
Sure. So why cheesemakers use artisan practices, this has been done for hundreds of years in Europe, mm-hmm. and now we've seen this wonderful trend in the United States over the last 30 years. The reason, so we think of cheese, it's a fermented food, mm-hmm. and you produce cheese from microorganisms that are either inherently present in the raw milk that is used to make cheese, or in the environment where that cheese ages during affinage when it's cared for as it matures.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we look at the surface of many cheeses, you see a very complex rind that is formed of very ordered microbial communities.
Mm-hmm.
And these microbes originate from the forages where the feed for the cows or sheep or goats is produced, in the aging environments, in the wooden tools that are used in cheesemaking,
mm-hmm.
and really contribute to unique flavors and characteristics
mm-hmm.
of these cheeses that reflects their either regional place of production, or what's even more fascinating is the various cheese families, cheeses that belong to certain families like Blumy Rind.
Mm-hmm.
If you're producing a Blumy Rind cheese in France versus the United States, you will see the same ordered members of the rind consistent with both France and the United States, even though the subspecies might be a little different.
Mm-hmm.
You're basically using that cheesemaking technology to select for these microbes that are just endemic in cheesemaking environments. And
mm-hmm.
I think that information is so very exciting. Rachel
mm-hmm.
Dutton
mm-hmm.
and her colleagues have pioneered that very complex molecular biology work.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it just opens up a whole new area of inquiry and ability
and interest.
Of cheesemakers
yeah.
and interest to further
yeah.
diversify their cheeses
mm-hmm.
and produce some great additional cheese varieties.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm. Now, I also loved a very thoughtful obituary of Lucy Appleby from 2008. And she argued that cheese was a living thing in which the natural bacteria enhanced the flavor and texture of the final product. To pasteurize it was to kill its character.
Yes.
So
and,
she was a very nice advocate for cheeses from England.
No doubt about it. And I think that is one of the most poignant obituaries I've ever read. It's
yes.
just so beautifully crafted, but
mm-hmm.
really shows a woman who devoted her whole life to
mm-hmm.
raw milk cheesemaking. And what's interesting is very elite purveyors in England, you know, when they started tasting this cheese, I think of Randolph Hoxton, that
mm-hmm.
Neil Jard Dairy,
mm-hmm.
he'd never tasted a cheese like that before,
mm-hmm.
and it really formed the cornerstone of his whole business that has really done more to promote artisan cheesemaking in the UK and to introduce to the UK these cheeses from the past that consumers can now enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're wonderful products.
Yes, yes. Now, you quickly inform the reader that the FDA's cheese regulation is, quote, at best questionable, at worst incorrect. So how did you get into this argument?
So what's interesting is throughout my scientific career, I think I've been really fortunate to be able to work with scientists at both the United States Department of Agriculture, as well as the Food and Drug Administration. Mm-hmm. My interest in cheese began with my interest in the bacterial pathogen Listeria. And when I moved to Vermont in 1983, there was a major outbreak of listeriosis that had occurred in Boston, Massachusetts, linked to pasteurized milk. And nobody knew anything about Listeria as a foodborne pathogen at that time. And so my lab started work on developing detection methods for detecting Listeria in foods, including milk, and then worked closely with the FDA over a number of years to refute the theory that the CDC was purporting that Listeria could possibly survive pasteurization. And so we did some wonderful work with the FDA to show that pasteurization was very effective in killing Listeria. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it was post-process recontamination and not survival during pasteurization that explained the appearance of Listeria. Mm-hmm. And so I've always had a wonderful relationship with scientists at the FDA. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've published papers together and shared knowledge. We participate in conferences together. And so when the artisan cheese regulations that were coming out of the agency, when I took a look at those, I said, this is not based on the credible science that I'm used to dealing with in mm-hmm. the agency. Mm-hmm. And so things had changed at the FDA.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and I felt, in terms of challenging those regulations, it's very difficult if you're an artisan cheesemaker to challenge regulatory authorities.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a tenured full professor, and so my challenge was based on, here's the scientific evidence that I'm looking at. The evidence that I see is inconsistent with the policies that you're writing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hmm. So that helped you be the person who should get into the fight?
Yeah, I think so. I think what would be a travesty for our country would be the day that regulatory authorities abandon science and decision-making.
Mm-hmm.
I think at
mm-hmm.
the heart of mm. the work of the FDA, they make important decisions about drugs and medical devices and our foods. And so to have credibility, the information coming out of the agency has to be scientifically sound. And when it's not, I think scientists have an obligation to point out that this data or this regulation that you're promulgating, the scientific evidence does not support where you're going on this.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so I felt very comfortable mm-hmm. raising issues from my perspective, someone on the ground who had done a lot of work mm-hmm. with Vermont's artisan cheesemakers, looking at the microbiological quality of raw milk used in cheesemaking,
mm-hmm.
Very high microbiological quality. And so these attempts to ban the use of raw milk in cheesemaking, again, were inconsistent with what the microbiological profile of that raw milk was used in cheesemaking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt very comfortable challenging mm-hmm. the FDA mm-hmm. on where they were going with these regulations.
Mm-hmm. Let me read another quote from the book. The raw milk cheese debate is really a debate over where and how our food is produced and by whom. The values that we individually place on methods of food production and the conflicting roles of tradition, heritage, and quality versus advertising, marketing, politics, and profits, which ultimately influence our food choices. I loved that quote.
Oh, thanks, Diane. Yeah, and to me, that's really what the book is all about. And I think artisan cheese offered, in my mind, some of the best examples of where
yes.
we're going wrong.
Yeah.
And you look at, you know, food safety, for instance. It would be so easy to overnight change our food supply just based on, okay, we have a zero tolerance for, you know, any kind of contamination, whether it's something mm-hmm. that it's hard. I mean, I think, let me step back for a minute. First of all, with artisan cheesemakers, you're not going to have a saleable product if you're making your customers ill, right?
Right.
So food
right.
safety is something mm-hmm. that is completely important.
Right.
And what my group had done over 15 years was work really closely with artisan cheesemakers to help them put practices in place that would allow them to not only make safe foods, but also foods that were of really high quality mm-hmm. because artisan cheeses sell for very high prices.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you look at the industrial model of food production in the United States,
it's completely different.
It's completely different, mm-hmm. exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at the corporations that are calling all the shots on how that type of food is produced, they have seats around the table when regulations are getting promulgated. They've mm-hmm. got the ear of the FDA. Where does a small-scale food producer mm-hmm. get to impact how these regulations are produced?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we would be very wise as a country to ensure that when we're promulgating regulations, we hear from a multitude of voices, large and small and industrial mm-hmm. and artisan,
mm-hmm.
that shapes good policy.
Mm-hmm.
But this blanket, we're going to write these sweeping regulations that are designed to get rid of all the artisan production potentially
mm-hmm.
and allow a monolithic food supply mm-hmm. out there.
Mm-hmm.
And when consumers speak with their voices and pocketbooks, it's very clear, especially given all the interest in artisan cheese, that's not the industrial model of food production is not the only model that consumers are
mm-hmm.
seeking.
Mm-hmm. So let's discuss the evidence. The first chapter is the FDA's assault on artisan cheese, phase one. Can you summarize why did they lower the amount of E. coli so crazily?
Yes, so crazily. So, very good question. And what's interesting is normally when regulations are going to change, the agency goes out of its way to hear from the multitude of voices that
mm-hmm.
are out there.
Mm-hmm.
How will this impact your business? And where's the public comment? If you look at what happened in 2009 and 2010, the changes were made on very limited public comments
mm-hmm.
that were largely from large industrial producers. The artisan cheesemaking community had no idea that these regulatory changes were being made.
Uh-huh.
And what's really interesting is my group had worked with the former Cheese of Choice Coalition back in the early 2000s, trying to get information from the FDA on the domestic and imported cheese compliance program. And what we found in that data, there was some E. coli data, so we went back and reanalyzed it more recently
mm-hmm.
and found that when the FDA is saying, well, these standards that we're promulgating, the really low E. coli levels,
mm-hmm.
Are easy for cheesemakers to comply with, our data had showed that between 66 and 76% of the cheese samples that the FDA analyzed between 2004 and 2006 before the regulations were changed, those cheeses did not meet compliance with those new regulations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for 76% of samples to exceed now mm-hmm. the E. coli standards that the FDA was about to promulgate,
mm-hmm.
there's something wrong with that picture.
Now, was
that
really wrong. Artisan cheese or was that industrial cheese?
It was domestic and imported cheeses. The imported cheeses would largely be artisan cheeses,
mm-hmm.
Parmigiano
mm-hmm.
Reggiano,
mm-hmm.
some of the, you know, famous French varieties,
mm-hmm.
lots of Italian mm-hmm. cheeses,
mm-hmm.
a lot of UK cheeses.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, that's crazy. Well, so why, when the FDA says it does things, but it doesn't do them, like that I don't understand How can they, like, you write about following the ICMSF guidance, yep. International Commission on Microbiological Specification for Foods, and then they ignored it.
They completely ignored it. And again, what I've noticed during my career is, you know, back 30 years ago or longer than that, the FDA had an amazing microbiology group in Cincinnati. It was world-renowned. The science coming out of that microgroup was so great.
Oh, that's
and
good to hear.
And those were people that I, but it's long gone. It's all been closed down.
Actually closed.
There's no more microgroup in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. And what I've noticed with the FDA over time, a lot of the scientific expertise has been replaced by legal expertise.
Mm.
And again, you need that scientific evidence to correctly inform decision making.
Mm-hmm.
And when you don't have it, you might make some mistakes.
And they have.
And those mistakes might be intentional.
Right, right. Okay, we have to take a break. We'll be back with Dr. Donnelly from the University of Vermont soon.
This episode is presented by Henry's Wine and Spirit, a go-to shop for anyone interested in natural wines and boutique spirits. There's a large selection of everything from orange wines, pet nats, and reds from around the world. Whether visiting the shop in person or online, looking for a gift for a loved one, or that everyday dependable bottle, you're sure to find lots of interesting wines at Henry's. There's free shipping on orders over $300 on the website henrys.nyc and case discounts when you visit the store located in Bushwick. Cheers.
So we're back with Dr. Donnelly from the University of Vermont discussing her book, Ending the War on Artisan Cheese. So now tell me about the second assault in the book, the wooden boards assault. When did this come out?
So this was in 2014
when
some New York cow artisan cheesemakers knew that the FDA was starting to take a look at enforcing regulations around the use of wood in cheesemaking. Some cheesemakers in upstate New York had been inspected by the FDA and had been cited by using wood in cheesemaking. And so an extension faculty member at Cornell University, Rob Riley, asked for clarification from the FDA and ended up sending a communique to the artisan cheesemaking community saying, hey, you know, I just heard that the FDA is going to start enforcing a ban on the use of wood in cheesemaking. And so that communique worked its way to Vermont, and several of our in Vermont artisan cheesemakers had started getting in touch with their congressional representatives, being worried that they just made multi-million-dollar investments in wooden aging facilities, and had asked specifically Congressman Peter Welch if he could look into what the FDA was doing. So in March of 2014, one of Congressman Welch's staff members had sent an email down to the FDA saying, our cheesemakers are concerned. Could you tell us what's going on? And the communique that came back from the Office of Public Affairs at FDA was, yes, we've looked into this issue, and the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition is going to start enforcing a ban on the use of wood in cheesemaking. It's not a new regulation, but it's one that's now going to be enforced. And
is that
so
true, that it wasn't a new regulation?
Well, the regulation says that materials shall be of such workmanship to be adequately cleaned.
Okay.
That's the regulation. Mm-hmm. And so the feeling from the FDA was wood did not meet that criterion. Mm-hmm. Wooden shelves did not meet that criterion.
Mm-hmm.
So back in March, the staff member working with Congressman Welch sent a message to the artisan cheese community, and I was copied on that saying, hey, I checked in with the FDA. I've got some really bad news for you.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, the artisan cheesemakers, not only in Vermont, but in upstate New York and elsewhere, mm-hmm. started taking to social media, telling mm-hmm. their consumers, hey, sorry to tell you guys, but, you know, we're not going to be able to age our cheeses on wood any longer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just wanted to let you know, and this is a really tragic development.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the FDA started getting some negative information, and so they published a constituent update in June saying the what you've heard from social media that we're enforcing a ban on the use of wood in cheese making is not true. We've never said this. And
it only took a few months.
It only took a few months. But what's really interesting is Congressman Welch became upset because he said, wait a second, I've got this March communique from you saying you mm-hmm. are going to do a ban on the use of wooden boards in cheese making. And now you're telling us in June that you're not. And so he has this wonderful tweet on his Twitter feed saying the FDA's right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing, which FDA should cheesemakers believe?
Right.
And so what was really interesting about the timing of that particular communique was so Congressman Welch had joined forces with Paul Ryan from Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
The FDA's budget was hitting the floor of the House the very week after this whole kerfuffle happened.
Oh,
and so
perfect.
Congressman Welch and Congressman Ryan, who happened to be the Speaker of the House at that time.
And is from Wisconsin, so is clearly going to be on the right side.
a very important cheese state.
Right.
And so Welch and Ryan got 56 of their colleagues to sign this amendment to the FDA's budget saying no amount of this appropriation will be used to enforce a ban on the use of wooden cheese aging.
Oh,
and
excellent.
That's how that issue got settled. So when there's talk that there's no longer bipartisanship, I point to this as an example of how parties from both sides can work together in the interest of citizens of the United States.
And in the interest of cheese.
And in the interest of cheese.
Yes.
What could be more important?
Well, but Paul Ryan took a turn for the worse before he left. So who knows? Who knows if he would have still stood up for cheese? Now, does it help to have Whole Foods and Wegmans involved in that fight?
I think it absolutely does.
Mm-hmm.
Again, when you look at the collateral damage mm-hmm. of, you know, such a broad sweeping regulatory proposal, Wegmans, Whole Foods, a big part of their bottom line is derived from cheese.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot
mm-hmm.
of artisan cheese mm-hmm. that's getting sold. And so this is an important economic issue. And
mm-hmm.
I think, you know, when the artisans have large organizations like Wegmans and Whole Foods
mm-hmm.
equally being harmed because they can no longer potentially sell those products. Yeah, I think that's very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think this was more of an anti-European cheese development, or do you think they purposely were attacking artisan cheese from America?
So I think, you know, that's a question that I had the whole time I was writing this book
mm-hmm.
is
yeah, because you don't come totally out and say it. But I read it into the book.
Yeah, well, I think initially, you know, there's a whole, and for a long time, since 2003,
mm-hmm.
There's been concern about U.S. industrial cheesemakers
mm-hmm.
being concerned about the protection of cheese names by the EU. So,
so
I think initially that issue drove some of this regulation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what I ask in the book, did U.S. artisans just get erroneously caught in this crossfire,
mm-hmm.
or were they two targets?
Mm-hmm.
And I still don't know how to answer that question.
Yeah, yeah.
It still remains a question.
Now, it does seem like the FDA is a little bit malicious in that it's coincidental that a company that went to a press conference to promote cheese boards was investigated the very next day by the FDA.
Yes. Yes. And is that called retaliation?
Right.
And that particular cheesemaker, you know, the again, emails, you know, call me paranoid, but,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
The artisan cheese community, they work with their suppliers and their
mm-hmm.
retailers.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's lots of support. And, you know, when many individuals are noticing patterns of behavior, it's more than paranoia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you also write about the day after a workshop in Georgia on food safety and hygiene. They went to every cheesemaker in attendance, plus two Whole Foods, and took their cheeses.
Right, for sampling and
yeah.
testing.
Yeah.
And again, here's Whole Foods, who helped co-sponsor a workshop
right,
on safety.
Right, right.
And through their co-sponsorship, they're now being singled out for targeted FDA inspection. And the ultimate irony with all of this, again, because I teach a food safety and public policy class,
mm-hmm.
one of the problems that Congress has had with the FDA is their inability to do frequent inspections of
mm-hmm.
food facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
the General Accounting Office issued a report saying most food facilities in the United States have gone 5 or more years without an inspection.
Right.
And so knowing that information, it's like,
then
well,
they can pop up at a cheese store to take their cheese.
For artisan cheeses. And when you look at this from a big risk perspective,
right.
that activity certainly seems out of scale with
and
what's
suspicious.
Needed to ensure.
Yes.
Exactly.
And totally
exactly.
suspicious. Now, I didn't realize how unbalanced European cheese versus American cheese was. We apparently eat $1.5 billion of cheese, and they in Europe, they get $143 million.
Right. So there's a huge trade imbalance
in
dairy. And most of it is due to the importation of European cheeses here.
Mm-hmm.
So our U.S. consumers love these artisan products. And
mm-hmm. Yes, yes. So that's really good for the artisans. But it's still quite striking for the cheese community.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
And in my role, when we ran the Vermont Institute for Artisan Cheese, it's like, well, one way to address this imbalance, let's start making great cheese here in the United States that
right.
consumers would want.
right.
And that's
right.
happening, right?
Right. Yes,
and,
it is.
Yeah.
And cheese from Europe is getting more expensive. So, it's working out, actually, in our favor.
Exactly.
So what
unless,
do we do?
Unless it all gets closed down.
right, right. So what do we do now? Part three of your book is what do we do now?
Right. So one of the things, again, going back to looking at good food safety and public policy, we have got to demand as citizens, as scientists, that our regulators understand food production.
Mm-hmm.
They understand how foods are produced.
Mm-hmm.
And there's ample evidence to show that people writing regulations in Washington really have limited knowledge on how foods are being produced.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't understand how foods are being produced, you can't understand the risks and you can't understand how to best control those risks.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got to demand that, and the example that I use in the book is, let's take romaine lettuce, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
When you don't understand what risks are, what you do is say, okay, everybody should refrain from eating romaine lettuce.
Mm-hmm.
Who does that? That doesn't help anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows that no one really understands the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Not all romaine lettuce in the United States is contaminated and serves mm-hmm. as a source of infection. We've got to do better than that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it comes to cheese, we've got to demand that the FDA work with our artisan cheese community and not engage in retaliatory behavior, but mm-hmm. work to understand how do we put in place controls that best protect public health.
Mm-hmm.
And we know how to do that. It's mm-hmm. not rocket science.
Right, right. Now, you talk about the USDA versus the FDA.
Right. And
what
so, you know, my area of expertise is Listeria.
Mm-hmm.
And so the policies that the USDA has written for control of Listeria in ready-to-eat meats
mm-hmm.
actually incentivize processors to go find sources of Listeria in their food processing plants because they know once those sources are identified and eliminated, you make safer products.
Mm-hmm.
In the FDA, the regulations, if food processors go and test their environment for Listeria and find it, food plants aren't sterile. So if you are doing a good job looking at sources of environmental contamination, you're likely to find Listeria.
Mm-hmm.
But in the FDA model, if you go and find Listeria, you have to notify the FDA, and the FDA will probably initiate a recall. Well,
okay.
initiate a recall
right,
of your products.
Mm-hmm.
So what the FDA has done is disincentivized food processors from finding sources of Listeria. The USDA incentivizes producers, and the data from the USDA shows how their approach has reduced the burden of illness from ready-to-eat meat products
mm-hmm.
from Listeria.
Mm-hmm.
So their policies are working. These are people that understand how ready-to-eat meats are produced.
Mm-hmm.
And so I argue in the book that we might be better off having all foods regulated by the USDA as opposed to the FDA that, again, has responsibilities for drugs and medical
mm-hmm.
devices,
mm-hmm.
and they've got a full plate. Maybe food regulation would be better done by a different agency, the USDA.
Now, how did cheese get to the FDA?
You know, a lot of what we have now with food regulation is it's historically defined. So
mm-hmm.
different acts that
mm-hmm.
have been legislated have put regulatory authority in the hands of either the USDA or the
mm-hmm.
FDA.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, since those acts were promulgated, the Federal Meat Inspection Act, that's USDA
mm-hmm.
Versus FDA that has regulatory jurisdiction over meat, over milk and dairy products.
Mm, okay.
But if you fast forward now to the year 2020, there have been numerous attempts in Congress to say, you know, we need a single food safety agency
mm-hmm.
that has authority for regulating the safety of all foods. And
mm-hmm.
I really feel like that time has come.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that the Trump administration is the one that's proposed giving that regulatory authority to USDA for
mm.
the safety of all foods.
Uh-oh. So who's bigger? Is the USDA bigger than FDA? Or, like, how many people work for each? Where are they?
Right.
Do you
and
know?
So that's, I don't know the answer to that question
mm-hmm.
in
mm-hmm.
terms of size. And
yeah,
and
I wonder.
I can tell you that as a federal agency, USDA is one of our largest federal agencies.
Mm-hmm.
And again, a lot of the size of USDA has to do with honoring treaty obligations to
mm-hmm.
foreign nations.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the food domain, I don't know how to answer that question in terms of personal size.
Yeah, I don't know either. I just thought of that question at the end.
Yeah. Exactly.
Anyway, so, well, thank you so much for discussing this book, for writing this book. It's just very amazing to read all this.
Well, thanks, Diane, and thanks for this wonderful interview. Your questions are just wonderful, and it's been really, really enjoyable.
Oh, good. Thank you. Thank you very much. So this is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd for HeritageRadioNetwork.org, and we'll be back in a month.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.